It said lots of the goblins were using scimitars, and the scimitars are the curves.
Scimitars.
Scimitars. There's a C in there, buddy.
I know, it's silent.
Since when?
It's silent.
whatever. A scimitar. Right, actually, it is scimitar. Let's do it.
All right.
We're on to the big battle. The big one.
Indeed.
All right. I'm Patrick.
I'm Clifford. This is episode 17 of the Talking Tolkien podcast. We're talking about chapter 17 of The Hobbit, The Clouds Burst.
This was a big one, you know. We thought Smaug's death was going to be a big one, and it was. But after that, this might have actually even topped it. I don't know. Well, we can talk about that. But anyways, for this one, a lot happened. So, yeah, it's all pretty important. But I couldn't really decide what to narrow down. So I think what we're just going to do is we'll talk for a bit about the pre-battle stuff that happens. Clifford can kind of just direct the conversation. Then for an equal length of time, or maybe slightly more, we'll talk about the actual battle stuff that happens. And then after that, we will begin the conversation of one of the big, massive themes that any Tolkien podcast must talk about. Yeah, Tolkien's creation of Ucatastrophe.
Exciting.
It is. Oh, it is, Clifford.
All right.
All right, before that, let's go. Cliff's notes.
Okay, so we return to Thorin and company with Bilbo at their side. They remain holed up in the mountain, and Bard and the Elven King return to parley with Thorin. Although Thorin assumes that they are feeling the heat of Dane's impending arrival with his army of dwarves, and that they're willing to compromise, Bard instead reveals the Arkenstone, which they propose to trade for the treasure that is owed them. A furious Thorin doesn't know what to make of it, but Bilbo quickly admits to being the culprit. Thorin's on the verge of throwing Bilbo off the wall, but Gandalf appears and orders him stop. Bilbo flees to Men and Elves, and the parley group departs, giving Thorin a day to produce the treasure. Meanwhile, Dane and his army, rough and strong, arrive earlier than expected. While they prepare to battle their way through the Men and Elves' camp to get to the mountain, Bard prepares to strike back. But Gandalf appears at the last minute, just as a dark storm is brewing overhead. He commands them to stop their bickering, for the storm is a cloud of bats, which is leading a host of goblins mounted on wolves from the forest by the Misty Mountains. The elves, men, and dwarves drop their differences and quickly prepare to battle the goblins and wolves, who arrive shortly thereafter. They set up a pincher front on either side of the valley, hoping to trap the goblins between elves and dwarves and crush them. The battle begins and seems to be going well. But the goblins' numbers are stunning, and they continue to flood in from all sides, even as Thorin emerges triumphantly from the mountain. When hope seems lost, Bilbo, who's been hiding out and invisible this whole time, spies a long line of eagles swooping in from the heavens. He's promptly knocked out by a rock, which I thought was a pretty funny way to end the epic battle chapter.
Yeah, that might have been uncommon at this point, but we should probably save that for later. We shouldn't start with the very end of it.
No, getting knocked out of the rock.
All right, where do you want to start?
So, yeah, at the start of the chapter, Bard and the Elven King show up with the Arkenstone.
Okay.
Intending to bargain with Thorin, knowing that he loves this more than anything else in the world. Do you think this bargaining had its intended effect? It kind of seems like Thorin is really flustered and shocked, but he doesn't immediately drop to his knees and say, I'll give you anything you want for that.
Well, Dane was close by, so if their desired effect was to actually get treasure out of Thorin, you know, peacefully, and, like, return the Arkenstone, and then they actually get the treasure, no. I mean, because Thorin, he was kind of calculating where Dane was for days and days before this, really. So, you know, right. I don't think, like... This didn't massively change anything, it just sped things up, which was definitely Bilbo and Gandalf's desired goal. I don't think that, you know, maybe Bard and the Elven King thought they could have success actually trading it, but I think Bilbo and Gandalf knew, like, this is just gonna shake things up for the better and bring things right. to a speedy right. conclusion. Definitely Gandalf okay. did that. I don't know if Bilbo really did. Well, Bilbo might have, yeah.
Well, on that note, Bilbo came forward right away, immediately after Thorin was saying, I suspect a thief. You know, how'd you get this from me? Bilbo fesses up right off the bat. And then it seems like he gets let off relatively easily.
Yeah. Well, I thought he was honest. I think that's nice. That's a good quality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do you even play that out, like, trying to hide that or conceal that? Because, you know, Bard and the Elven King, they all know what's up. And then, mm-hmm. also, mm-hmm. we gotta remember, Thorin was, you know, he was very pissed at Bilbo and he was about to, I don't know, at least... I don't know about physically hurt him, but, you know, he was going to come to blows with him, really, you know, because he was so enraged. But then
right.
he wishes, like, he says, like, I wish Gandalf was here right now. And then it turns out Gandalf is there because he's the old man who's carrying around the Arkenstone for the Elven King and Bard.
Right. Is that just Gandalf appearing to save the day?
Well, I think it was, you know, Gandalf kind of slightly... tamed Thorin or kept him in line a little bit, you know, because, I mean, Thorin knows he owes Gandalf for helping organize this adventure, and then
right.
he also, you know, he has to know that he owes Bilbo. Like, Thorin could not have done this without Bilbo.
Right, which is interesting, because Bilbo pointed that out, but, you know, Thorin kind of ignored it and cursed him anyways.
Well, and then also, like, one of the parting things they said was... He noticed that Bilbo was still wearing the mithril vest, and, mm-hmm. you know, he says, like, you're not worthy of it, but, you know, I think just, like, the fact that he didn't even take it away kind of implies, like, yeah, he's, I don't know, he acknowledges all that Bilbo's done, and he doesn't, like, quite regret giving it to him, because if he really regretted it, he right. would have just told him to take it off, give me it back, you know, like, get out of my face.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess I was surprised that Thorin, being kind of treasure blind... dragon sick, is still being reasonable and respecting the authority of Gandalf and giving Bilbo some faint recognition for the things he's done in the past.
Well, like, I mean, maybe...
Irrational and rational Thorin don't line up in my head.
Well, I don't know. Maybe he's still got... Maybe it's like a bit of that honor culture that he's still got going on in him. You know, like He's okay. still the old heroic warrior who... They respond very favorably to acknowledging debts and
right.
deeds, good deeds that have been done. So, I mean, you know.
Right. Okay, so speaking of debts, seems to me like Bard could have gone after more than this 1/14th of the treasure. Because, as a little recap, Bard presents the Arkenstone as like, kind of, what now, Thorin? And Thorin says, oh my god, who stole this? It was you, Bilbo. You're dead to me. You forfeit your treasure. Bard, the only thing I'll give you is the treasure that would have gone to Bilbo, and then you can split it between the two of you. And seems like Bard was kind of content with that, which surprised me, because before he had the Arkenstone, he asked for 1/12 of the treasure plus supplies to help rebuild Lake Town.
Yeah, I thought that was weird, too. Yeah, he's definitely downgrading. I mean, you go from 1/12 plus a little extra down to 1/14.
Yeah, it's like he was surprised he got anything, and so he's like, okay, I'll take it.
Besides that Dane was coming up, there's no ship, like, power shift. I mean, he was still in a commanding position, so why would he ask for less, besides that he's just trying to be reasonable and end the conflict, I guess?
Right, it felt like one of those jokes from, like, watching people bargain at a market, and it's like, I'll take a 12th,
or
I'll give you a 14th, sold.
Or, this is all an acknowledgement by all parties, including Thorin, that Yeah, okay, Bilbo gets 1/14 of the treasure, and this was actually a fair pick of the Arkenstone. Because in the last chapter, we were kind of on the slightly on the fence, like, well, was Bilbo in the right to even give this thing away? But now, right. Thorin's kind of acknowledging, like, okay, yeah, this can be the 1/14, and then I get it back, or whatnot. So
I'm trading you a 14th for a 14th?
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, Bilbo said it was his 14th. Bard is basically saying, like, yeah, give me 1/14 because this was Bilbo's. Gandalf seems in line with the plan. And then Thorin mm-hmm. agrees to give up 1/14 of his treasure for it, too. So I think even he would acknowledge it. So, you know.
Perhaps. It still doesn't seem fair to me because...
Well, it's not fair. It's not fair for Bard, but, you know, I'm mostly just saying it gives legitimacy to what Bilbo did in the last chapter by...
I guess so. That's true. That's true. Like, Thorin protests, but ultimately he's accepting the scenario, right? Right.
So, what Bilbo is in the right the entire last chapter, because we had been wondering, was he just doing something where, like, ends justify the means? But I'd say no. I think he was in the right the entire time.
Okay.
But, yeah, I don't know what Bard's really doing. Yeah, maybe it's just like speedy, like, all right, let's just end this. I need something, you know, for my people.
He's glad to be getting anything. Or maybe the treasure's so massive that 1/14 is like, hey, I'll take it.
Yeah, that's true, too. I mean, yeah. You know, what I also wonder, too, is like they expect Thorin to bring it out over the next day. But it's like,
yeah.
Well, is somebody going to go in there and inspect that they actually got a 14th? Like, you know, how do you yeah, measure that without seeing the hole? At least eyeballing the hole.
Also, what I've gathered from this whole description of everything is, like, you've got some massive cavern with mountains of gold that they're crawling over. And then there's, like, a small little patch of muddy dirt in front of a pool of water. In front of a giant rock wall at the opening to the cave. Like, there's not even space to pile up all of the shit that is inside the cave, right?
Well, yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's true, too. Yeah, you know, that might just kind of be, like, one of those ancient concepts that we can't really conceptualize. It's a similar situation to where you see in any movie, like, where it's either ancient or medieval times where,
mm-hmm.
you know, they buy somebody off and they just throw them a little sack full of gold. It's like, yeah. How do they know that that's the right amount? You never...
And it's always the same sack, right?
Right. I mean, in no movie do you ever see them actually, like, check. They might check to make sure it's actually gold. But, you know, they just base it off the weight. And right. Then, as if, like, I don't know, I guess they can just kind of tell by the weight. But, I mean, it's not like they count up the pieces in the bag. You never, ever see that.
Maybe they're using Bitcoin.
Okay. Moving on, I guess.
Okay, so Dane and Bard, as their armies are moving towards one another, they certainly waste no time preparing to destroy each other. Are Dane and Thorin thinking alike on this? Is Dane, because he's been communicating with Thorin, so treasure blind and kind of crazy the way Thorin is at the moment?
Is he super crazy? I don't think he's like, he's got like a sickness like Thorin, but I mean, they're completely in league. Thorin's the real head of the family, so Dane probably has to bow down to him. I believe they're first cousins. Whatever. They're very close relations, mm-hmm. so they probably do think in similar ways.
Okay.
But, yeah, and I mean, you know, any dwarf, though, it's just like, hey, this is our family treasure, we're going to defend it. Because it was both of theirs.
Right, right. And I guess another part of that is Bard also he didn't strike me as particularly reasonable here. He's like, oh my god, an army, let's prepare to kill them. Not, maybe I could reason with this guy, let him know that his cousin's gone off the rails, and say, look, we're trying to bargain for what's rightfully ours here. Will you, on your honor, respect our claim to part of this treasure?
You gotta remember, too, the ravens have been communicating between Thorin and Dane for them the entire time.
Definitely,
as well.
Definitely.
So, again, I think Dane just has to bow to whatever Thorin wants to do.
Okay, fair.
Yeah. I thought the meeting between them was funny, because this is one of those times where it's like, it's one of those classic examples of the heroic epic talk that we've been talking about, but then mm-hmm. the narrator also just spells stuff out like he was doing at the beginning of the book. You remember that? So it went like this. We are sent from Dane, son of Nain, they said when questioned. We are hastening to our kinsmen in the mountain, since we learn that the kingdom of old is renewed. But who are you that sit in the plain as foes before defended walls? This, of course, in the polite and rather old-fashioned language of such occasions, meant simply, you have no business here, we are going on, so make way or we shall fight you. Yeah. Mm-hmm. See, I thought that one was funny.
It is funny.
Yeah. Okay. What other things before we move on to the actual battle? Anything else?
I don't think so. You were curious what mattocks were?
Yeah, I had to look that up. First of all, I thought the Danes' armies, there was a description of the army right before they met Bard's guys, which is the part we just read. I thought the dwarves sounded pretty cool, pretty battle-hardened. And then it sounded
very
like,
heavy.
Yeah.
Like, everything's made of iron, and they're wearing cloaks of metal.
Cloaks.
Yeah. Basically, right?
Right. It sounds like a Maddox?
Yeah.
Which
Maddox?
Maddox. That's got to be the Midwest way to say it. There's no way it's actually Maddox.
Maddox.
Mattox. Mattox doesn't work for me.
All right, whatever. Yeah. How do you say buttocks? Okay, anyways, keep
Maddox,
going.
All right, so yeah, the Maddox, though, if you're wondering, they look like picks, then they definitely look so like a pickaxe, you know, like what you use for the ice, uh-huh. But then it definitely looks more weaponized, you know, like it would actually do well. Which is, I don't know, a little interesting choice. Before we get to the battle, or maybe this could be the transition of the battle, it said lots of the goblins were using scimitars. And the scimitars are the...
Scimitars.
Scimitars. There's a C in there, buddy.
I know, it's silent.
Since when?
It's silent.
Whatever. A scimitar... All right, actually, it is scimitar. That's another thing. I did the same thing in the elves chapter... Because
mm-hmm.
I said the word Celtic a couple times, except I didn't say Celtic, I said Celtic. And I was like, and I was editing it, and I was like, Patrick, what are you doing? This is ridiculous. Anyways, scimitars, those are the curved swords, you know? They're kind of used, like, they're probably associated, you know, like Aladdin. All the soldiers in Aladdin have scimitars.
Mm-hmm.
Just use that as a reference.
It's also sometimes like a Grim Reaper type sword.
Yeah.
Although that's usually on a... The Sith is usually on a... Well, it's like a scimitar on a staff.
Dude, it's definitely a scythe. It's not a Sith. I will not accept
scythe.
All right.
Get into the battle. Okay, so Gandalf, queuing off this thing, he appears right in the middle of the dwarves and elves about to... launch a war against each other, tells them to stop and says, you know, pay attention to yourselves, look what's going on, these bats are the vanguard of a goblin army about to attack you. What do you make of this? First of all, it's the second time in the chapter that he's jumped in to save the day or assert his authority. Felt to me like he's like a real father figure here, to the point of like making the elves and men and dwarves seem a little childish.
Yeah, it seems... I don't know. Was it really a surprise? Just that... I mean, because it seems like it's been a long time since you read it. Like, I kind of know this book, like, back when...
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, so were you surprised when he, like, just was in the middle of a battlefield between dwarves and elves and men?
I wasn't surprised that Gandalf was there. I was a little bit surprised that the goblins showed up.
Okay. Well, so
I knew that they were coming at some point, but I couldn't remember exactly when.
Right, so it's no surprise that Gandalf, basically, though, before we get to the goblins, it's no surprise that Gandalf stops a bunch of all basically good forces fighting each other.
Right.
You know, I mean,
yeah, that didn't surprise me all that much.
And I mean, like, Gandalf, you know, you could say father figure, you could say, I don't know, just kind of ringleader, or... kind of like proponent of just good things, you know, kind of just rallies any sort of good force wherever he goes. It was almost predictable. I mean, if you want to, do you have anything more on father figure, or were you just thinking that?
Yeah, it just came to mind. I mean, I see that he's obviously the good guy, and he's trying to keep the good guys from fighting each other, which makes a lot of sense. But this... like the way that he stepped in made the conflict seem a little bit silly to me. Like, Thorin's being a baby about this. Are you guys really about to go to arms over a petty conflict? It felt like, you know, someone stepping in and be like, knock it off, kids. Stop roughhousing.
Well, I mean, maybe it was petty on the dwarves' part, but I think, you know, it wasn't silly what Gandalf was doing. But then, and I also don't even think it was silly that Bard and the elves were going to go fight him for this treasure. Because, I mean, you know, the men need it. But then again, could they just get all their supplies from the elves? And the elves and the men don't want to fight the dwarves. I mean, the Elven King was kind of like, you know.
Yeah, counseling patience.
If we have to, we will. But it'll cost us heavy losses, and I don't really want to do it, you know, to fight these dwarves. But, I mean, they need the gold to rebuild their town, because what? They said they'd send the gold down to men in the south, I guess? Or...
yeah, to buy new things, and etc.
Right. You know, I guess you can kind of question, like, how come the elves can't just do this all on, like, credit or something, and the men eventually pay them back? Now, even to do that, they'd need a share of the treasure, I guess, but I don't know. Yeah, I mean, it seems like Gandalf was kind of just, if he's a father figure, like, you know, stop horsing around, I think that should only really be directed towards the dwarves. The men have no choice in this situation, because they have no homes and nothing to do. Like, they need some sort of material wealth at all.
So Gandalf pulls them all together. By the way, goblins are coming. Let's make a quick battle plan. Did you get a sense of what the timing was for all this? Because it sounded like it was happening very quickly, but there were a ton of things happening, so I got the impression that it was a little bit slower.
Well, all right, so let's do this on the fly, because I didn't actually think about this. How long has it been since Smaug died? I think Smaug dies, and then it's basically about 2 weeks before the elves and men get up to Lonely Mountain, and then they camp out with Thorin, right? And then from there, I'd say
when the elves and men are camped out, it's what, 2 nights or something until this ultimatum?
Yeah, but no, but there's more time between that, because there's like the first party in chapter 15, you know?
Right, I apologize. Yeah, they're camped out for a while.
Yeah, I think it's like, let's just, I don't know if it's generous or conservative, but let's just say another 2 weeks. So, like, let's say this is a month since the death of Smaug. All right, and so then, you know, we heard when Smaug died, everybody from Beorn to the goblins in the Mist Mountains were hearing about it. So that's, like, a big deal. And So then there's, like, a paragraph description about how the goblins basically all rallied around to basically the top of the Misty Mountains. I guess, I thought we were done with geography, but you can actually go, if you open your map to the big map, not the Lonely Mountain map, you'll see at the top of the Misty Mountains, it says Mount Gundabad. So, basically, all the goblins let them know that what the dwarves had done, and then they all grouped together to go there. And I think they were just going to hunt around the plains, but then when they heard Smaug died, there's that mountain chain that runs east-west at the very top called the Grey Mountains, and it sounds like they snuck through there all the way to the end of it, and then the Lonely Mountain is, it's not a part of that mountain chain, but it's slightly close that they can just come down from the north to get there.
Right, because they hate mountains, right? Or hate sunlight, rather.
Yeah, and then also, like, them traveling in the mountains is just, you know, nothing could watch out or scout for them. Right. Now, apparently, if we remember the last chapter, Gandalf knew that things were coming to an end, and even stuff that the ravens weren't aware about. So Gandalf, it seems like, kind of had some idea that they were coming, but the book also said, like, well, he didn't expect it this soon.
So they're moving quicker than he thought.
Right, yeah. And we also have to remember that they have wolves and wargs. So, you know, the wargs that we know, but then it sounds like they're just riding regular wolves as well.
Yeah, I was confused by that. He clearly made a distinction between wolves and wargs.
I would just guess wargs can talk, because we heard him talking in the one chapter, and then wolves can't.
Okay. But both are kind of these big evil versions of what we would consider to be wolves.
I don't know if the wolves are bigger. Wargs are bigger.
Wolves, I mean, if they're riding wolves, they've got to be big.
Oh, yeah, I guess. Okay.
And then this big cloud, what they thought was birds and turned out to be bats. Is that kind of like an actual storm or just a storm of bats? And what was it there just for show, or does it actually help block out the sunlight to let the goblins travel during the day?
Perhaps to that. We could probably get to the bottom of that in Lord of the Rings.
Okay.
I think our next question should kind of be, what's the size of these armies? So we
So I was going to ask, what's the size of the armies? And then, I guess we were already kind of diving into this, but what I would consider the geopolitical background we should know about this. Like, what players from what areas are coming in? They mentioned Bolg, who I was guessing is the son of Azog.
Yeah, it said
it. We've mentioned before.
It said it in like a little asterisk note at the bottom.
Okay, I didn't have that.
Really?
I don't think so.
I think you did.
I'll check my book.
Okay. Alright. Well, yeah, so I mean, son of Azog, we know who Azog is, you know. That's one of the joys of listening to this show. You know who it is, you know? When Gandalf's yelling out, it's the army, the goblin army is led by Bolg, son of Azog, you know, we all know who Azog is because we listened to chapter 4 of our podcast.
Well, let's just say I'm some goofball who decided to start on chapter 17. Azog is a big deal goblin.
He was the leader of the goblins when they had the dwarf wars in Moria. And, you know, Gandalf literally says, Dane, you remember Azog, you killed him. Now it's his son who's here, you know, so it's... Gotcha. Now, how goblins have sons, definitely not getting into that right now.
Okay. Also,
probably just unclear, even possibly for a Lord of the Rings, but...
Okay. Yeah.
But, you know, somebody...
So anyways, we've got a personal rivalry here.
So we know Dane had 500 dwarves, okay?
Right, that's mentioned a few times in this chapter and last one.
Right, and so then the Elven King...
And they sound hardy.
Yeah, so they sounded like really good fighters, but based off the Elven King's words, like, yeah, I know we can take them, it'll cost us a great loss, but I know we can take them, they're outnumbered with elves and men combined.
Right.
If you ask me, I guess, yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, if it's going to be heavy casualties, I don't know, I thought, what... Maybe twice the size would be appropriate. Maybe that's...
Yeah. Actually, quick pause, because I feel like this is in the last, like, two chapters ago. They mentioned how big the Men and Elves camp is.
It would have to be in chapter 15.
1 second.
Okay,
I can't find it.
All right, well, I busted out the Atlas of Middle-earth.
Okay.
I was trying to do it, you know, I was trying not to rely on this thing, but, you know. Oh, they do the timelines for us, which is definitely, I don't know, maybe we should have relied on this more, but I guess we're not too strict, if you haven't figured out on this podcast. Alright, anyways, Dane brought 500 grim dwarves, which we knew. The Elven King commanded at least 1,000 spearmen plus archers. And while Bard's forces were uncertain, they may have been as few as 200, judging from the size of the town. Well, that's actually kind of some numbers.
Okay.
I was going to guess 500 dwarves. Well, we knew that one. And then, so I thought it would be closer, you know, more balanced between men and elves, but I guess not. And that kind of makes sense. The elves are in the huge Mirkwood forest, whereas Lake Town, it was probably small.
Right. How many elves did you say again?
He said 1,000 spearmen plus archers. So plus archers, I don't know, 20% of that, so another 200. So 1,200 elves, 200, 300 men. I don't know, so 1,500 there.
Okay.
So we
let's generously say they've got 2,000 collectively, men, elves, and dwarves.
Yeah, and then the goblins are just a really big host. And it seems like, you know, they were really calling up from the whole Misty Mountains chain, which is a big chain. So...
And I got the impression that it was beyond the Misty Mountains. This was... They were pulling from all over the place.
Well, it was the Misty Mountains and then all the mountains on the way there. Yeah.
Okay.
So I would say well over 2,000.
Okay.
Yeah. How much, I don't exactly know.
Plus the wolves.
Yeah, plus the wolves. Well, the wolves definitely put it over 2,000. Yeah.
Okay. So point being, there's way more goblins and wolves than there are men, elves, and dwarves.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah, so the good guys are outnumbered in this thing.
So they are obviously pretty smart, the good guys. They set up their pincher movement, basically, where they kind of hide on or line up on either side of the valley, up on the top of the slope in the forest, wait for the goblins to rush in towards the center of the mountain, and then they descend from above, which is, as they pointed out, really good military strategy, assuming that everybody's in the valley. It's terrible military strategy if you're outnumbered and more people come over the edges from all sides, which is exactly what happened. So, sounds like they were kind of smart, but put themselves in a bad position because they were so outnumbered.
Well, also, they saw the goblins and wargs come in, and it did seem like they could... Like, the ones that came over the mountain after them didn't come until later. Like, that was, like, the second...
Right,
it was
like, exactly. Yeah. Exactly, that's how they didn't. They
yeah,
didn't
so, but I mean... Yeah, what else are you going to do? I mean, when it comes down to just numbers versus numbers, I mean, I'm no general, especially ancient general. Well, no, modern or ancient. I'm no general, period. But, I mean, in an open field battle, I think it's just, you know, unless you got, like, more cavalry than somebody else, how the hell does a smaller force ever win? Unless there's some sort of strategic advantage to it.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the whole point, is you have to have the strategic advantage.
Yeah, you have to be extremely good commander. So, I mean, like, they had no other options, even if they were or weren't counting on them coming over the mountain, is what it seemed like.
Correct, correct.
But they did, and so, well, so anyways, though, that first attack, they kind of did well, because when they were just coming into the valley, they could kind of, yeah, they could attack them from both sides and whatnot, yeah.
The elves swept down from above, and then the dwarves swept down, and it sounded pretty epic. They're doing a great job slaughtering goblins, etc. And it was like each wave was successful, but then they kind of got beat back, and the goblins kept rushing in. And then Thorin rushes out of the mountain
It seemed like they were doing well when they were just in the valley. Like, they had almost won it, but then all of a sudden they come over the top, and then it's like, ah, shoot, now we're real screwed, you know?
Right. They're being swarmed from all sides.
Yeah, basically. And then it's, like, starting to get dire, and then Thorin bursts out. So, yeah, we want to talk about that.
Yeah, Thorin and the other 12 dwarves rush out, looking pretty, like, they said they're all dressed up in their fancy armor, their eyes are glowing red. So they're fired up, and Thorin's fighting like the king that he should be, and tears through the goblins, makes it to the other dwarves, rallies a bunch of men to him. So he's basically fighting like a big deal battle hero at this point. My question was, like, where did this come from? How did he go from selfish Thorin hanging out behind his wall to valiant hero?
Clifford, that was my question.
Oh, well, no, I think I had the same question. I think you might have claimed it.
Well, I didn't see it in your question. All right, whatever. Well, anyways, yeah, I was wondering about this too, because it seemed like he kind of flips the switch almost. My guess would be, well, it seems like when he comes out, he's like actually kind of commanding men and elves to even, like, he was inspiring and rallying them as well. So it wasn't just...
Yeah, he's like a real proper old-fashioned general.
Right, yeah. So my thinking was, well, you know, yeah, he's very greedy and selfish. He wants the gold. But again, the old heroic element of him, it's just, hey, man's being attacked. You know, especially when he sees other dwarves dying, you know, his own kin. I mean, it's like, hey, I gotta do my part. You know, this is ridiculous. I'm the king under the mountain. I can't just be sitting here defending the treasure from men and elves and goblins additionally while everybody else is dying. It's like, I have to do my part. I gotta be, like, the big badass warrior who leads them, you know? So I think at the very least that's going on.
Okay, and then, you know, he's coming out with 12 other dwarves who... we've heard are, you know, clever, but maybe not the world's best fighters. Are they really making that big of a splash in this massive battlefield with, like, hundreds of bodies clashing against each other? He's described like he's the main thing happening in the battle, and I'm thinking 12 people crawling out of a cave.
Well, again, they're inspiring the men and elves that are around them that are real close. Fair. You know? And so then it's like, I imagine Thorin might be stealing the show. Maybe a couple other ones that are, like, battle-hardened. I mean, Balin's old. Then again, Thorin's old as well, so I don't know. But, you know, Balin, maybe he's old. maybe a couple are young, so they wouldn't be super dynamic and dominant. But I don't know. Some of the other ones, they seem pretty capable. Probably not Bomber. I don't know.
No. Okay, so did you think, was this symbolic, Thorin coming out of the mountain? Was this like definitive transformation for him? What you're saying with how he's rallying elves and men to his side feels like, you know, he's reached like the highest state of camaraderie, or not camaraderie, more like they are his compatriots now. They're fighting on the same side. They're responding to him.
I don't know if it's symbolic, but I think it's at least it starts to redeem him, you know.
Right.
I mean, okay. He's not just like, Thorin, I hate your guts. Like, what are you doing here? This story could have been over if it wasn't for you, you know. I think
right.
So. I mean, he's starting to get good credit again. All of our books.
Right.
Because it sounded cool when he charged out. I mean, it was kind of short, but it sounded cool.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, it sounded awesome. So, what about Bilbo this whole time? He's been out of the action, it sounds like. He put his ring on as soon as the battle began, so he's invisible. But then by the end of it, I got the impression that he was kind of up on the hillside, along with Gandalf, basically watching the action.
Yeah, it seemed like Bilbo didn't put himself in the thickest of things, you know?
No.
But, I mean, no he was doubt. Definitely, like, running around in the battle, so that's cool. And, I mean, he's got the ring. Might as well use it. And, I mean, we have to remember, too, like, yeah, Bilbo's the hero. He's proven himself to be a hero throughout this book. But I think we right. all know it's not like he's William Wallace. You know, he's not going to go charge out in the middle of a battle and, like, in the complete chaos and, like, come out. Or, like, you know... I've been watching Vikings a lot, and, you know, and uh-huh. it's not like he's Ragnar or some Ragnar.
No.
You know, he's not gonna. I mean,
he is for all intents and purposes not the ancient epic hero that we've talked about,
right? And again, I mean, it's like, well, we can relate to that too, I guess, because like, well, what would I do in this battle? Jeez, I'd probably be off to the side
yeah.
too. I don't know.
Yeah.
Or I don't know if I'd be in the thickest of thick. I'd say that, but yeah, who knows.
And then Gandalf is also up there with him. Is Gandalf, you know, due to his wise observer status, not really taking part in this?
It's not so much observer, it's... Well, maybe it is. I don't know.
I mean more in the sense that he's not standing in the middle of the middle of the battlefield like shooting lightning bolts or something like he did in the cave with the goblins.
Yeah, maybe he's surveying to see how he can best, you know, serve the purposes of the good guys here. But again, too, it's like we've seen this whole time, like none of these adventures are, you know, Gandalf's not doing any of this for his own benefit or his own reward. He's doing this to help everybody else out. So you can't expect, I don't know, when he doesn't do too much, you can't really get pissed at him.
Fair.
And then also, because it's not really his role. You know, his role is to... I think we've already seen enough that his role is to inspire other people to do what they have to for their own people.
Right.
You know?
Yes. Definitely.
Now, is he ducking out? I don't think so. I think he's just, you know, that's where he was stationed. That's... I mean, it's not like he wasn't fighting, but I don't know. It's a long day. You know, who knows? And how does the day end?
Eagles. So, let's get into this, what you were mentioning at the start of the episode, this concept of eucatastrophe.
Yeah, it might be ooh.
Eucatastrophe.
Eucatastrophe.
I've never heard of this before, so will you give me a quick rundown or quick explanation for this?
All right. I think to start with breaking down the word itself.
Okay, cool.
All right. What's the big word in there that you see?
Catastrophe.
Yeah, so catastrophe... is which language?
Sounds Greek to me.
Ooh, good for you, Clifford. All right, nice. So, kata means down, and strepho means to turn.
Okay.
So, a downturn. So, catastrophe, whenever a catastrophe happens, means a downturn in a story, or overturn, or like, I don't know, it kind of implies to me like downward spiral, or, you know, like
right.
things take a turn for the worst, literally.
Okay, you know? Okay.
But then ooh means, take a guess.
Eucalyptus.
Your best guess will be, I don't know how well you remember. Well, yeah, your best, I don't actually know if you'll recognize this word. Your best guess would be based off Uangeleon.
Is that from Game of Thrones?
No.
What is that from?
Uangeleon means refers to the gospel.
What about the Eucharist?
Ooh, it might have a relation to that as well. That's not a bad guess. Okay. It probably does. I haven't looked that up, though. Yeah. So, if we're doing that, right. Gospel, what does gospel mean?
The good word.
Good news. Yeah.
Good news.
The Uangeleon, you know, like the gelet, like the... If you read it out, you can see the word angel.
Okay.
And angel means messenger, so news, you know.
Okay, so interesting.
Good news. So U means good. So we're talking about a good catastrophe in here. Or so like a good twist or turn of events, you know.
Okay. So it sounds like it could be a little contradictory, but maybe it's not, if we're just seeing it as a turn.
Right. Well, it's like the least expected thing.
So he means catastrophe, but opposed to the traditional understanding.
Well, it's a... No, I mean, it is kind of what it sounds like. It's a good catastrophe. So catastrophe like, you know, so... When I was reading, so what we're going to talk about here, we're just going to talk about, just to preference this before we really get into this, we're going to talk about what eucatastrophe is, or eucatastrophe is, and then I'll give one example that I think he would have been inspired from Tolkien's own life, or, and it's not an exact example, it's just like probably a collection of examples. He writes about it most famously in his essay on fairy stories. I think it was a lecture that he ended up giving, and then like it was published or whatever. So if you want to learn more, you can read that. But we'll talk about it more, like all his academic and personal life, personal views of it in Lord of the Rings. But for right now, we're just going to talk about like what it actually is, and then that, and then like a couple of possibly personal examples. So anyways, he was basically saying like the true form of drama. So, you know, when we talk about drama, we're talking about like plays. So, you know, most famously probably Shakespeare, and then, you know, like Greek plays and everything. And so the true form of that is tragedy, where, you know, it ends with like a sad ending, like Romeo and Juliet, they're both dead, spoiler. But in fairy stories or just fairy tales, again, we'll get into fairy stories, Lord of the Rings, just go with, you know, this is a fairy story, basically what you can take away. In fairy stories, it's the opposite. It's the eucatastrophe instead of just the catastrophe that happens. You know, like the tragedy, the dramas take a turn for the worse and end up being a tragedy, you know? Whereas here, it's the exact opposite.
Right.
The true form of fairy tales at its highest function is eucatastrophe, like a good turning of events. I mean, it's like basically Tolkien says like fairy stories, it kind of has to happen, or else it's not a real fairy tale. Like there has to be like a good turn of events, you know, like that has to be a thing,
right?
It's the super joyous happy ending, because it's the good catastrophe, because it's the sudden joyous turn of events. All hope was lost, and it was lost in this battle. If you read that, like, this is like, I mean, sure, it was kind of short, but these are pretty bad descriptions, really. You know? I mean, like, it did not look good. Like, even Gandalf was like, what can I do for, like, a last-ditch effort thing here? Which, yeah, that's another conversation, but yeah.
Like, everything's looking down, and then there's this moment of hope.
It's kind of like the happy ending, you know? Or I mean, that's exactly what you expect, is, like, when all hope is lost, all of a sudden, boom, something happens. Almost miraculously, kind of like by grace, almost, you know, that's the word he's using in his on fairy stories thing. Now, it's important to note that he doesn't deny this catastrophe, which would be bad catastrophe, or just like, you know, total failure, but actually, because like that's actually kind of necessary to create the greater joy of the deliverance.
When you say he doesn't deny catastrophe, you're saying he doesn't reject it as a like general concept in his writing, or it's specifically a part of the eucatastrophe.
Well, no, that's like totally a possibility in this situation, and there's probably other situations, like if you read The Silmarillion, where it did have a sad ending, and that was it, you know? Like, it was, they did fail or whatnot. And so, like, it's not, so he's saying, like, yeah, that could be a possibility here, but that doesn't happen, which makes this even greater, you know? Like, that's even more, mm-hmm. like, that it's so awesome that this happened, and, like, this is, like, a really good story. But what it does deny is, because if you see this, you see this in every fairy story, so this ends up denying this idea of an ultimate universal defeat or like right. failure, you know. So like, so at the end of the road, all these fairy stories are pointing to, sure, there's been defeats and there's evidence that like everybody will, you know, everything will end in time, but altogether there's going to be some sort of universal victory, and like it will have like this crazy happy ending you catastrophe here. Now that we're starting to get into the whole bigger scope than what I want to do this episode, but yeah, what do you think of that so far?
It's pretty interesting. You stop me if this is a diversion, but it's an interesting point that you mentioned. Like the Silmarillion, for example, we see places where you do have catastrophe, but it feels to me like this concept of you catastrophe, even if Tolkien coined the word, is pretty common throughout a lot of modern storytelling and a lot of modern mythology. Right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, he coined the term basically like for academic purposes because he...
To describe these fairy tales, for example.
Yeah, because he picked it up in like what he was saying, like, you know, it's not a real fairy tale unless it has some sort of twist like this, you know?
Right. Okay.
But I don't think it's just limited to just fairy tales either.
No, certainly, no doubt. Do you feel like that, like, in talking about that it's a modern, like, a characteristic of a modern story? Like, a definitive or defining trait of a modern story?
What kind of modern story?
Well, take, like, a modern mythology of some sort. Like The Hobbit or what have you. Versus some of these more ancient stories that we've talked about before on the show.
No, I think it's in both.
Okay, it comes up in both places.
Like somebody was, I'm not going to get into this, but somebody gave the example of something I was listening to, like, this happens in the Odyssey. Well, I guess we can do it real quick. Like, Odysseus reveals himself all of a sudden, and then he strings the bow and he starts killing everybody, which is like, oh, that's a good thing that he's killing everybody, but I don't know, he's our hero, so it is kind of a good thing. Justice, maybe, I don't know. You know, so like they use that as an example out there, and again, he's basing this off of like all sorts of fairy tales that he's reading, where you know it has a happy ending. Maybe that could actually be something. I don't want to. This is like a rabbit hole, but like maybe that's why these things get degraded to just the bedtime kids' stories. You know, because they do have the happy ending all the time. Maybe when they were
right.
Yeah.
So. If the Silmarillion, though, and I can think of other kind of older mythologies, are not so soft in that way, like they a lot of the stories don't have happy endings, and I think for a lot of people that's what's so potent about them, or so sad in certain stories, is that they have straight up sad endings.
Well, so here's the other thing too that we should mention about eucatastrophe. He says this is a good turn, but he doesn't say like it's. And sometimes
okay.
I like
it's not a good ending.
Sometimes it, right? Sometimes he kind of says happy ending, but it's just like, well, no. Ultimately, you know, there's no true end to like a fairy tale, and like just for our lives too, it's like, you know, there's no true like super happy ending because we do die eventually. But you know, what he was saying was all of these point to something beyond life. That's like that'll be the ultimate happy ending, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's what he's getting at there. And I mean, do you see that in all mythologies? I don't know. You know, like the Norse one with Ragnarok, the gods all die, but I think it's pretty well established that like the whole world burns up in ashes, but then there's like two humans that hide out, and from the ashes they like repopulate it or something. Don't quote me on that. there's something about that there. I want to get into where he might have formulated this in his own life, though.
Yeah, certainly. That was a thought throughout this. For this whole battle, I was curious, is he pulling from references? in his own life or in like history.
Well, this I think is possibly the most direct thing we've seen of World War One so far, or most direct influence of World War One influence that we've seen so far.
Okay.
Because I think, you know, first of all, like, just to put the scope, and I think we'll get into this, this will be like a pretty decent sized topic for the next chapter, but like, this is a kid's book, and this is a massive battle.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, this is like, these are bold moves for the child story, you know?
Definitely. And it's not like it's, I mean, he goes through a lot of stuff quickly, but there's certainly plenty of mention of people slaughtering each other.
Yeah, for sure. And like there was that line, like, there were so many elves that should have lived, you know, thousands of years more, but their life was cut short at this battle.
And yeah.
It's just like, dude, you're hitting us.
Definitely.
But I think, like, this, so we got to remember, Tolkien was in the trenches. I don't think he was really in the trenches for more than 6 months, because then he started getting sick and everything. But he was definitely in it, and he was in battles. So what was going on, and this is just, like, a very prolonged battle, so it wasn't like it was, like, constant, like, guns never stopped firing. They probably did, but it was the Battle of the Somme.
Right.
Which, I mean, I don't remember.
Was he in the Battle of the Somme?
Yeah, he was in it. Yeah, okay. That was what he was in. I don't really know what really distinguishes it from the rest, because all the World War One battles, it's like...
It was the biggest.
Yeah.
Or the biggest on the Western Front, at least.
Yeah, maybe this is the one where they introduced tanks. I don't really even know. But, like, because, you know, all World War One battles on the Western Front just amount to thousands and thousands of people died, and then the winning side, and I put that in quotes, ended up getting, like, a mile or 3 miles deeper into the trench line, you know? So it was like a very Pyrrhic victory. Like it wasn't really that great. Like maybe they have a strategic point, but you know, they had terrible losses. So like, who cares?
Right.
Or not, right. Not who cares. Cause many people died. So a lot of people cared, but it's just, it didn't end up actually coming to mean much in the scope of like the trenches.
Yeah. Point being, it was one of the bloodiest battles in human history.
Right.
And it was when tanks were introduced, and they gained, I think maybe they got a couple miles, or like up to about 10 kilometers across enemy lines in certain portions. But in the grand scheme of things, that is a small amount of territory for the amount of fighting that was done.
Right. So, and then in these battles, I mean, you know, I don't want to get too in-depth with it, partly because... You know, again, I'm not like an expert or whatever, but they would have like offensives where it's just like, okay, this is the day where we're really going to push through and like charge and everything. So we got like this unit is lined up and they're going to go and attack, but then there's this other unit that's going to support them at this time and everything like that. And so, you know,
right.
We're going to hope that our artillery goes and like weakens the people so that you can just charge in and everything. But, you know, there's sometimes where the stuff doesn't go to plan. Like, you know, the Germans were dug in really well, so the artillery that the British were firing at them to loosen them up before had close to no effect. So then the Germans were ready with their machine guns as the British were charging.
Right.
And then, you know, some whole unit, maybe it's like the side of like a battalion or something like that, which is really big, or regiment, I don't know, whatever.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
they get pinned down, and they're just like hiding in the muck, probably just so that they can avoid machine gun fire and whatnot. And so then like they get to the point where it's like, man, they're in no man's land. How the hell are we going to get out of here? What's going to save us, you know? Like, I mean, we're screwed. Like they're basically, you know, they do lose all hope, and it's just like, man, this is how I'm going to die, like out in the muck here, you know, because our battle plan screwed up basically, you
right
know?
Right.
But in lots of those situations, and now Tolkien was probably actually on, he might not, I don't know if he was ever often or ever at all in that situation where he was like the pinned down one, but in lots of those situations, it definitely did actually happen that some other British unit or regiment came up at the last minute from like, you know, the side or the flank or whatever to give them cover fire so that they could retreat back, or did like come ambush the Germans so that they could take over and like actually gain territory and save the troops that were pinned down.
So there are some direct parallels to this battle that from the chapter.
Yeah, it was like last second kind of stuff, like how the Eagles come in and save the day at the last second, mm-hmm. just like in this chapter. He saw that as soldiers were doing it, and he was actually, I think it was probably more likely a case that he was often part of the soldiers that like came up at the last second to save the other guys as opposed to being the lethally pinned down guy.
Right. Because a lot of those guys didn't survive.
Right. Well, correct. Yeah. That's basically my reasoning to think he was probably on the coming up and saving side. Yeah.
Okay.
And so that was a real thing. And I don't know. I was just thinking, do I have a specific example of that? No. But I think it probably happened like multiple times there. And just I was thinking, I remember watching History Channel back when it was like good. Though, well, not as Vikings, but other than that, the rest of that channel is pretty bad.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah. Although, though, those restoration shows, I think those people actually do a pretty good job. So those shows are mildly cool. American Pickers and Pawn Stars can cut it. One of the things, though, that was a pretty new invention for World War One was they had watches for a while, like pocket watches, mm-hmm. but this is the first time they had wristwatches, so they could coordinate attacks like pretty precisely.
Okay.
Troops are supposed to move and everything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was definitely the first European war where they had those.
Mm-hmm.
Or big European war where they had those. They might have, I don't know if they had them in the American Civil War. I tried to look it up because the railroads had it, but I don't know if they had the railroads were regularly using it before the 1860s.
Yeah.
It might have been.
It's an interesting thing. It's also in the chapter, we've got the ravens flying back and forth between Thorin and Dane constantly. It's like a proto cell phone communication situation where like they're getting away or getting over the fact that they have encumbered communication. They've got these other ways of functioning cohesively.
Well, as far as like gadgets go, I mean, nothing's ever gonna, well, no, up until this point, nothing in history has rivaled how much of a game changer smartphones have been. But
right.
back in this time, like the wristwatch was quite the game changer. I mean, the iPhone's crazier, but the wristwatch was pretty crazy for them at that point, because now it's just like you had complete accuracy. Like what we were saying with like railroads and everything, and then also, coordinating battle plans almost to where like, yeah, you can mm-hmm. precisely come in, swoop in and save the day at the right time, which is what we're talking about with this U-catastrophe stuff.
Well, so the ultimate, I guess, U-catastrophe of the chapter is the Eagles coming in.
Right. Yep, they did that. And yeah, so, I mean, we've seen the Eagles more. They came in and swooped in and saved the day the last time, partly just on a scouting mission.
Right.
We don't really...
Because they hate goblins.
Right. We don't really know why they're here, but maybe they had seen the goblins mobilizing or something. Who knows?
Yes.
They had heard about the Death Smog, because it sounded like everybody did in the Misty Mountains.
And it certainly sounds like they're here for battle, because Bilbo saw a long line of them.
Right.
He said it must have been every Eyrie of the North.
I mean, maybe we'll get the lowdown in the next chapter if the good guys won. It's still an if at this point.
I'm going to guess the Eagle arrival is a good sign.
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, we're completely thinking at that, because this is the U-catastrophe part. They are like the random happy ending, like the surprise happy ending when all hope was lost.
Uh-huh.
And it's that. And I really, we really shouldn't be saying happy ending. They're the good twist, the good turn.
Like, right.
Oh,
right.
We did not expect this. This is sweet. Awesome. We saw that in the chapter where they save the dwarves. We saw that when they first appeared in the Silmarillion, because we talked about that story, when Fingon was saving Methros, if you remember all the way back to that. Listen mm-hmm. to chapter 6 again if you don't. That's just kind of what the Eagles do, is like they swoop into the rescue. And like I think they're the biggest, for me, they're the biggest symbol of U-catastrophe that we'll see throughout Tolkien's writing, though there are others.
Right. I'm excited to see where things go from here. Since Bilbo... I totally forgot. Bilbo got knocked out with a rock.
Yeah.
Is this not the epitome of a cop-out battle story? Where our narrator or observer just disappears or blacks out?
I don't know. You know, well, first of all, blacking out stuff's kind of common now in fantasy stuff. Like, seriously, remember those Hunger Games books?
Yeah,
like,
I remember. That was probably one of the funniest book reviews I've ever gotten from anyone, is you telling me, yeah, these books, in regards to the Hunger Games, these books are halfway decent, but I just wish that the author would come up with a better way to end a chapter than having Katniss black out.
Seriously, like, it's like,
you know what, you're right.
At least a third of the chapters ended with her just like, yeah, getting knocked out, or I don't know, shot or something. I don't know, something crazy. It's just like, yeah. So I don't know. It's kind of a common thing for us. But back then, I don't know. Again, we were saying, like, he's not William Wallace. What's he supposed to do? He's used the ring. We don't want him to get killed in this thing. He's, I don't know, he's near a cliff. I guess it's fine that rocks fall. I mean, I guess that's kind of likely. Yeah. He's wearing a helmet, so that's a good thing. No concussions.
It feels like yet another sort of example, or maybe driving the point home, that this is like a window into an older time. Bilbo is our modern character, our modern hero. He's our link to the present. And via Bilbo functioning as our narrator, he's like observing this battle of ancient epic proportion with these epic heroes like Thorin duking it out. But at the end of the day, he's an observer. He's like a window into this past, sort of. And the rock coming down is like a reminder that it's not that we're following the battle and Bilbo's to the side. It's that we are following Bilbo, and as soon as he disappears or is knocked out, whatever, that window closes.
Or maybe we can't, as modern people, can't really understand the battle. You know, like the ancient epic battle.
Perhaps.
Because, I mean, yeah, none of us have seen one.
True.
Except in movies.
True.
Yeah.
I believe those.
Well, should we believe those? You know, sometimes when they're super chaotic, I don't know if I quite believe that. Sometimes I feel like they'd be more orderly. You know, like the Romans do a good job. Or like the 300, like they did a good job where like they have like shield wall. They hold that up pretty well.
Yeah.
You know, but I don't know how often it really gets down to like there's like no sides whatsoever. And like, you know, like Braveheart or Vikings, or that, you know, like.
Yeah, or even Lord of the Rings. There's a lot of that.
Right, even Lord of the Rings, yeah.
It could have,
but
it gives me anxiety, like the whole concept that there's just like a free-for-all, and people are just swinging things and stabbing at things, and you're not accidentally killing a quarter of your own people.
Or like, you know, they stop for a second to get like an emotion out of the main hero, and it's like, well, dude, there's like five enemies behind you. You're just lucky that they're fighting other of your troops, you know. And
yeah,
like,
exactly.
Lucky they're not coming up behind you. So yeah, so I don't know. I'm not sold on all that, but then again, I'm not at all a warrior type, and I haven't researched any of that. And it's usually pretty entertaining when I see it in a movie, so I'm not gonna complain anymore about that. Yeah. True. The other thing is too, it's just like, again, kids' book. How long are we going to indulge in this huge battle? It's just massive battle.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair.
So it's like, that's what we want to do. That's what we want to do. These chapters are pretty abrupt. I think we'll talk about that in another next episode. Like, we'll put that in to talk about there. Because I think, like, yeah, this was an abrupt ending. They've kind of all been quick in the second half of the book. And I think there's a reason for that. And I think we've already touched on it. But yeah. Okay.
Interesting. All right, I'm back.
All right. So, yeah. So this was, what, today's 2/25/2019?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. How's your week, Clifford?
It's going pretty well. Off to a good start. Passed my second to last penultimate architecture exam.
Ooh, nice. That's exciting.
Thank you. How are you doing?
Oh, yeah, I'm pretty good. Yeah, I've been pretty good. Lots of reading going on. Big things happening in Patrick's mind. All right, anyways, we got a review here, and we should probably keep it quick, because I'm pretty sure, like, the past four episodes we've run long. So, this review here, we got 5 stars. Look at that, 5 stars. That's all we need, plus some words to make it fun. So, interesting contrast by Bromley underscore M. So I assume this is the Matt Bromley that I know from college running track with him. So Bromley
seems like a long shot.
I think I might have texted him to confirm. All right, so this one, just, you know, because I know Bromley can handle it, I'm gonna be a little critical of it, depending on what he says. So, you know, and this is only because I know him. You know, I wouldn't pick on anybody if I didn't know who they were. I mean, I don't want to offend somebody that's given us 5 stars. But anyways, While I gave this podcast 5 stars and it deserves it, period. So Bromley, that was not a complete sentence. I've read that a couple times, and yeah, I'm pretty sure on that. Anyways, while I've given this podcast 5 stars and it deserves it, let's say comma, Patrick and Clifford haven't mentioned the geology of any of the mountains yet, period. This is disappointing, period. That being said, the two have great chemistry and work well together. All right. So
is he a geology major?
Yes, last time I checked. Yeah, he is. So, first of all, I want to say... That would make sense. I don't actually think that's even true. I think in the Crossing the Threshold Misty Mountains chapter, I thought we talked about the rock giants for a little bit and, like, the cool description of it. Did we get into, like, I don't know...
What type of rock it was?
Yeah, science-y rock stuff. And, yeah, we talked about rocks with the mountain, like, cutting into living stone and stuff.
Okay.
So, you know, I'm kind of calling BS on Bromley here.
Well, we didn't get too sciencey there. Living stone is not quite a scientific classification.
All right, well then I guess we never will. But Bromley, I think it's fair to say though, in Lord of the Rings, we will probably devote more time to talking about nature, environments and landscapes. Though I think we can pencil that in, as well as I've been thinking some architecture. Partly just because I'm learning up on it, plus Clifford should be able to.
Is hopefully learning up on it also. All
right, well, Bromley, thanks for the review. How about you send an email to talkingtokenpodcast@gmail.com with your address and. No, I know it's you. Okay, I guess you could text me your address too. I don't know. Whatever. Whatever works for you. Thanks for the review. More people, guys, these reviews. These are starting to get kind of fun. The last two, those were slightly whimsical. That's what we're looking for. Whimsical, you know. Mm-hmm. Ended here, though. Clifford, you got anything else for the week?
I do not.
No? All right. Neither do I.
Thanks, y'all.